you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2021, and you're listening to episode 253, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Disney Plus series, The Mysterious Benedict Society, which is based on the New York Times best-selling young adult book series by Trenton Lee Stewart. On this episode, I'm joined by Jeffrey Ryder, who is Associate Professor and Coordinator of Literature at Lancaster Bible College, and he is an Associate Editor at Christ and Pop Culture. He holds a PhD in English from Baylor University and an MA in Church History from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Jeffrey has written an online exclusive TV series review for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called, "Does the Mysterious Benedict Society Have the Right Stuff?" And our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. And that's one of the benefits for being a subscriber, to be able to read these online exclusive articles and reviews. If you're not already a subscriber and would like to hear his take on the Mysterious Benedict Society, please go to equip.org to subscribe. Jeffrey, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me, Melanie. I'm really excited about this.
Well, if anyone has children and they're fans of young adult literature, you're going to be enjoying this podcast episode for sure, because we're going to be talking, as I mentioned, about the Mysterious Benedict Society television series. And for those who don't know, The Mysterious Benedict Society, it's a novel, a young adult novel written by Trenton Lee Stewart, and it was published almost 15 years ago now, and it became a New York Times bestseller, and it had various sequels and even a prequel, and so this is a series that's based on the first book in the series. So can you tell me a little bit more about the series, what it's about?
Sure. So the series in The Mysterious Benedict Society, it's about an individual named Mr. Benedict, Nicholas Benedict, who's kind of this affable, wise, older man. And as the books begin, he ends up recruiting several children to work for this sort of secret society or organization that he is founding. Now, you see this from the kids' eyes, so at first you don't really know who this Benedict is, particularly one kid. So there are four main children in the story who are also end up being the major characters of the streaming show as well. And so one character, Rainey Muldoon, he is the main child whose eyes you primarily see things through. And he ends up going through these series of tests, which at first seem like they're just kind of for like a type of gifted and talented school type of test, like nothing super extraordinary, except that the questions are a little bit odd, and some of the situations increasingly get weirder and weirder as the tests progress. And eventually what you find out in these early chapters of the book, as they pass through these tests, he ends up meeting up with a few other kids who have also seemingly passed through these tests, is that really they're not testing primarily their intellectual abilities. They're being tested on how they react to or respond to solving these unusual problems, and when their character is tested, how do they respond to that? So each of them is placed, for instance, in a situation where they could choose to help somebody or not, and where they could choose to cheat or not, and they choose the right choice in not doing those things, on one hand in helping people, but on not being duplicitous or dishonest. So the other characters besides Rainey, then the other children, are a child named George Washington, although he goes by Sticky because everything sticks to him. He just remembers everything. And then this girl named Kate Weatherall, who carries a bucket and has kind of MacGyvers her way through everything. She can just solve almost any problem with the right amount of glue or twine or something. And then eventually you meet this fourth little girl named Constance Contraire, whose only superpower seems to be that she's incredibly irascible and stubborn and sarcastic. But the four of them eventually get together where they meet Mr. Benedict and then a few of the other adults who work with him. And this crew together then are recruited to go to this top secret school. It's on an island away from the city where the story takes place. And they're sent to this mysterious island and this institute there because only kids can get there. So Mr. Benedict needs these kids to be able to be essentially the operatives, because no adult could be able to get into this environment. So he recruits them. He's very clear with them about kind of the risks and what's going on with them. and they ultimately, most of them are either orphans or alone or at least in very troubled situations, and they ultimately all choose voluntarily to go. They get sent to this place where they encounter a villain who is using subliminal messages through television and radio. There's no real internet in the world of these books. It's kind of a little bit old-fashioned, and so it's through other media like television, radio, and newspapers, but they're sending these subliminal messages to create this artificial condition called the emergency. And this emergency is not really any defined threat. It's just to make people feel anxious. And so they're trying to find out who this the main villainous leader of this island, Mr. Curtin, like who exactly he is, and eventually trying to stop him. And so that is kind of how the plot and how those kind of go with the first book. Like you said, Mysterious Benedict Society, the original book was in 2007. The following year, there was a sequel called Mysterious Benedict Society and the Perilous Journey. And then the following year after that, The Prisoner's Dilemma. And then there was a prequel about Benedict's story called The Extraordinary Education of Nicholas Benedict in 2012. And then most recently in the series in 2019, a fourth book, The Mysterious Benedict Society and the Riddle of Ages. There's also a lot of puzzles and wordplay, and there's actually a whole puzzle book in addition that was also published.
So obviously, as I mentioned, these have been New York Times best-selling books, and so there's been a fair amount of popularity for them. What do you think accounts for their appeal? I mean, I do think one thing that is appealing about it, I was saying to you before we started our podcast episode, that it reminded me a little bit of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, where you're really seeing these very interesting and unique events happen through the eyes of the protagonist, which is a kid, and in this case, a group of kids. And why do you think there would be interest in particular to say, oh, let's try a television streaming series based on this series?
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, I think that there's several things that have led to this particular series being popular. Now, I mean, obviously there's action and intrigue and mysteries to solve. And so, you know, having some of those is going to put you in good stead in the first place. But there's lots of books that have those. That's kind of a dime a dozen now in young adult things. So what is it that makes this series distinctive, like even more so than some of the others? And I think there are a couple of factors, and I think you pinpointed one of them. One is this sort of like whimsicality to it, that there is very much a distinct flavor to it. You said the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like the Roald Dahl books. And there is sort of this similar sense there that you're in this world that is kind of like our world, but like, I wouldn't call it a parallel universe or anything like that. And yet it's not exactly quite our world. They're in this town called Stone Town, which in some ways seems modern and in other ways has this very retro feel to it, both in the descriptions of it, the illustrations, and then in what happens. Like I said, it was written in 2007 in the first one, and yet there's no real internet. Yet the countries they refer to are the regular countries that you would expect to find. And that is similar to what Roald Dahl was doing in the Charlie books, where it's never really exactly clear where Charlie lives or anything like that. He's kind of just in their own sort of environment that's like enough to ours, yet also a little bit different. But I think another of the things that also makes this sort of popular is that it appealed a lot, I think, to students who might be coming from the GT or gifted talented sort of background. And I'm not sure all educationally or pedagogically what different terms you might use for this, but kids who have maybe special or distinctive or unique abilities, but who feel misunderstood or rejected because of them, or who don't fit in with other people. So all of our kids in this particular text are ones who don't fit in with everybody. Each one has a different skill set. Each one contributes something different and has a different kind of ability. But together, each one makes them greater than the sum of their parts. So they're able to solve all of these riddles and these things together by being the kind of weird people that they are, rather than by being very generic or following along with everybody else. And so with those kinds of appeals, you can also see how kids may be interested in bringing that to life. I mean, the plot follows along in kind of a nice way. And it's a long book. All the books are fairly long. I mean, not as long as some of the later Harry Potter ones, but pretty decent size, 350, 400, 450 pages long. So they lend themselves to a short series in the streaming mode where you can gradually develop things over time. And the characters are very memorable. The scenes are very memorable. So I think that there would be a lot of temptation to visualize them, to look at. When you're reading it, you can visualize a lot of this with or without the pictures, and the illustrations are very good. But even without the illustrations, I think you would be getting these very clear pictures in your head of them. And so wanting to get to see those on screen is pretty tempting.
So what's the background of the origination of this particular series becoming a streaming television series that's on Disney?
Yeah, it wasn't originally scheduled for Disney. So from what I've been able to follow along with it, it was originally supposed to be on Hulu. And was first announced in September 2019. And I had been always keeping my ear to the pavement to see if anybody would film something like this because my kids had been loving the books for several years. And I will say, as I'm presenting this, by the way, that I'm doing this all not just as a viewer of the show in abstract. I'm doing it as somebody who has read the books with his kids who love the books even and have read them much more than I have, and who is watching them with my kids. So I have kind of like the role of literary and film critic and the role of parent as well. And so I was always kind of attentive to or attuned to, like, are they going to film this? Because I could see them doing it. And so, yeah, September 2019 was when it was first announced. And there's a few writers attached to it. Todd Slavkin and Darren Swimmer, my understanding, are the show runners. And then Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi were a couple of other additional writers who wrote the premiere and then the finale and some of the other stuff as well. But the filming had some delays in it, not surprisingly. Look at the timeline, right? Because this is right around the pandemic time. So it took a little longer to put it into film than they were planning. And then I think it was in November of last year, 2020, when they announced that it was going to Disney Plus. And so that was a big surprise to me. I had no idea that was on the radar for anything. So then the first episode, as you know, they started dropping in June. So June 25th was the first one, and they did not follow the Netflix model of dump them all at once. It was kind of like a week at a time. First two episodes came out on the 25th, and then it was one more each week and through August. That is kind of my best understanding from what I've been able to read on how the books came to be understood and then adapted later on for this streaming series. And I have looked and offhand cannot find any interaction with Trenton Lee Stewart on his own thoughts on it. He doesn't give tons of interviews or give lots of personal information even when he does. So I presumably they have to have the rights from him or the permissions. I have not heard a lot from him specifically, though, regarding his own perspective on the series.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. We hope you are going to be entering in our contest for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. We are wanting to get to 100 ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts by the end of this year, December 31st. Right now we have 64. So we have a ways to go, but we are hopeful to get to 100. And when we do, anyone who's given us a short written review, even a few words in a short sentence, if you do that, you are automatically entered in if you do so after July 1st, which right now there's only one person so far, and their comment is they've been enjoying our author Anne Kennedy's episodes, and we've got a bunch of episodes coming up with Anne Kennedy, and so you don't want to miss out some of her insights on books and other topics coming up. So please head on over to Apple Podcasts to give us a rating or review, and we'd be very grateful. The other great way you can help us out is just tell a friend about the show. Just let people know about this podcast and have them listen to some of the episodes that you might be posting on your social media accounts. In addition, if you don't want to miss out on these great articles like the one that Jeffrey has written for us, then you want to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, which you can do at equip.org for $33.50. You not only get print magazine issues with articles that are not on the website that are exclusive to our print edition, but also you get online access to all these great original web-only articles. So you want to head over and do that. In addition, the other way you can help us out is just give us a tip. If a full subscription is not in your budget right now, a tip of even $3 helps us out. So you can do that at the landing page of any of our episodes at our website. Just hit magazine to the drop down Postmodern Realities, and every single episode that we've had since we started 5 years ago is up there, and you can give us a tip through that means. And thank you for your partnership. We were just talking a little bit about, you know, how the series came to be. And so, you know, one of the main things that people always consider when some of their beloved books become a movie or television series is, you know, what are the benefits to doing that? And what are some concerns fans might have? And all, of course, whenever you're talking about fans and, you know, converting anything into a TV series or film, there's always many, many opinions, and now with social media even more, about what people should or shouldn't do with regard to some of their favorite and most beloved books. So what do you think that people can think is a positive about this, but also some concerns that they might have about converting some of this material into the Disney Plus series?
Sure. And I don't want to just be doing something where I'm like saying like, okay, you know, oh, the books, they're better. I'm an English guy. So naturally, in one sense, I'll be thinking in terms of the books. But, you know, I want to look at the series on their own merits. But that being said, I do think the books have some very distinctive qualities to them that, as I'll talk about in a moment, that I think if you lost those, that would be potentially problematic, just in the sense that it would be losing some of what makes them so special in the first place. So some of the things that would be, you know, potential benefits, like I said, I was interested in the possibility of this series coming up. And as I mentioned before, like just visualizing some of these scenes, the characters are all, you know, it's got some great quirky characters and great quirky characters who have a lot of qualities to them, but even just visually, who have a lot of very distinctive features. So some of the adult sidekicks, like Number Two or Rhonda Kazembe or Milligan, who are some of Mr. Benedict's helpers, like they're so clearly realized in the books, and even the four kids themselves, that it would be really interesting to see how they were cast. And overall, you know, again, I think that we'll talk about this in a moment, I think a lot of the casting was fairly good. And, you know, like I said before, too, like the books expand over a long period of time. So in one sense, it's really good that you could have the time of a TV show, but not like a 20 episode TV series, but like, a good 8 episodes. That seems like about the right amount of time to expand something like this. Now, one concern I did have related to that, though, is that especially the first book, the second and third and fourth books are a little more overtly action packed. But the first one kind of really requires some patience. It takes its time to get where it's going. And I think that's good. And in fact, actually, I think that's one of its purposes. I think that in fighting against our lack of attention, I think that there is a deliberate, very methodical way in which the first book kind of progresses. But I was concerned about whether the TV show could kind of keep that very kind of slow burning approach to it. And so that would be one, you know, possible concern for it. And there's something that and I'll talk more about this down the line. I've never been able to quite sort of put my finger on exactly articulating it clearly, but there's a very kind of a quality to the books that seems very countercultural in the ways in which it is emphasizing sort of self-control and self-discipline and restraining or keeping back from things. That is something that the kids have to learn and that Mr. Benedict has to learn. And so one of my concerns always from the start was whether or not the books would be able to do this. Now, I don't know how many kids are actually thinking about that particular aspect, but certainly from my point of view, that was one. And obviously, just like, would they keep the plot, again, because it's kind of a gradually moving plot, would they sort of add in a lot of different things to it? How much would the emphasis really be on the kids? Because I've talked a lot about Mr. Benedict, but the books really, again, kind of focus from the kids' perspective. And so would we be able to see things really from the kids' perspective the way we do? Or would they be shifting that attention more toward the grown-ups or more toward the adults? You know, so I think that there's concerns about whether or not will they keep to the plot. But even if they don't keep to the plot, would they be able to address some of the thematic concerns or some of the core ideas from the books that are communicated? Those are things that I, as a fan and as a parent and as just a viewer, that I was interested in as I heard more about the show being presented and being produced.
Speaking of formatting a book into a TV series, in terms of the characters and the plot, how close to the books does the Mysterious Benedict Society TV series adapt them?
I would say the overall arc, the sort of like the big picture direction of where it goes in terms of plot is pretty close. Like, I mean, the opening sequence, particularly the first episode and the way that it presents the tests that the kids go through that I mentioned earlier, I was pretty optimistic when I was watching that one. I thought they did a very good job overall. There were several sequences when I was watching and I was like, yeah, this gets it. Like, this is a really good take on what was going on there. The more episodes you get into, the more you start to see little changes, and a couple that I'll talk about in a little bit, a couple of more bigger changes in terms of the plot of the characters, which become increasingly evident. But the kind of the finale of where everything lands, if you were to zoom out, I would say it's fairly similar. Now, as far as the characters go, again, I think that the characters are done fairly well, at least for the side characters. I would say that the members of the society, the four kids, in terms of their casting anyway, like in terms of do they fit the appearance, do they give the general ambiance of the way the kids are, I think they're pretty decent in that regard. The sidekick adult characters are very well done. So the characters who are number two, and Rhonda Kazembe and Milligan, who kind of assist Mr. Benedict, I think are really, really well cast. I feel like they fit it very well. Some of the side villains, some of the smaller villains who appear, okay, they diverge somewhat, and particularly in terms of some of the kid villains, some of the child characters who are not the good guys, they veer off a little bit. But I think the biggest departure, for good or for ill, and we'll talk more about this in a little bit, but like the biggest departure is really Mr. Benedict and then the villain, Mr. Curtin, who is in fact actually Mr. Benedict's twin brother. So the portrayals of these two characters, now I like Tony Hale, who plays them as an actor. I think he's an excellent actor. So I appreciate him for a lot of ways. He visually does not look anything like Mr. Benedict or Mr. Curtin. He plays both roles. He plays both of the twins. And I don't think he looks like either character very much as they are portrayed in the books. He also doesn't really act like them very much. So you get little details here and there that are similar, but there's also some pretty wide and significant departures. And so since the whole society is named after Mr. Benedict, I think that ends up having some ripple effects throughout the show. It certainly makes it a very different kind of show, whether it, you know, not necessarily better or worse per se, although it's going to become very different, not just in terms of what is happening, but in how we interpret what's happening as well. So I'd say that's probably the biggest departure. And my kids, certainly some of those, again, as fans, you know how kids are when they're watching something adapted from their stuff, even more so than adults, they'll kind of like really get into scrutinizing it. And especially with the parts with Benedict and Curtin, the Mr. Benedict and then the villain. Yeah, that sort of got under their skin, I think, a little bit.
So what do you think about the series in terms of its production value? And do you think it's good TV? It's interesting because a couple of years ago, we did a podcast when it first came out on Hulu of The Handmaid's Tale. And of course, that was something a lot of us read in the 80s in college, in the 80s and 90s, that original novel. And there were ways in which it was similar and different, but I felt like that the production values were really good and the acting was really good. And even as it has gone on from the original, because there was only one book, and now it's been several seasons, it's really well done. But not all adaptations of things are all that well done, so, or compelling television for that matter. So what do you think about that as it applies to the Mysterious Benedict Society?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And this is always a peril whenever you're adapting something, is that you have to be thinking as a showrunner or creator of something, you know, you're torn between the fan base, like my kids, who are, you know, wanting this almost scrupulous attention to the original thing, which never really fully works, right? I mean, a completely scrupulous point by point adaptation is impossible and probably would not make for good television or good movies. But at the same time, you know, you want to have something presumably faithful to the original as much as you can. So is it good television? Does it work well? I think it's pretty good. I think there's some really positive qualities in certain regards, like the set design and those components to it. Just again, visually, it's so wonderfully distinctive. I mean, I've heard some or read some articles where they kind of suggest some of its influences, like maybe the Netflix version of A Series of Unfortunate Events, at least as far as the aesthetic goes. And then also maybe like Wes Anderson films or some others, but some of this also just does actually come from the books. Like if you look at the depictions and the illustrations, it translates very nicely. So it's great to watch, I think, is wonderful, and has a theme. This is a small thing, but like the theme music is perfect. It just fits it wonderfully. As far as the plot and the characters go in terms of how they develop on a narrative level and on a character level, I think it's okay. I think it's pretty good. It's hard when you're dealing with something with children because they're real human beings, and they're real human beings who are not professionals in the same sense that a 25-year-old is a professional. But, you know, I would say that the child actors maybe sometimes, especially early in the series, but maybe even to a certain extent throughout, sometimes may feel you're kind of occasionally just a little too aware that they're reading lines at each other rather than actually having a conversation or a dialogue. And, you know, that's the inexperience that comes with, you know, many of these actors or actresses had not been in very many things beforehand, from what I can tell. And so, you know, they're kind of growing into those. And I do think that they grow into them as time goes along. I think that it has some strange pacing issues. Like I said, the books are themselves kind of slow paced. And I don't know that the show ever really figures out how quite to do that. So sometimes it seems like really slow moving, and other times you get these kind of like jumps in action, which seem kind of surprising or halting at different times. And I was honestly surprised by the finale, in the sense that, like, quite frankly, I found the finale a little dull. Like, it seemed like they went out of their way not to show action sequences. Like, they would actually like get to a point where characters were fighting and either stop them from fighting each other, or switch to another scene when they weren't. And I'm not saying that, you know, people beating each other up is the hallmark of great television, but there were just a lot of like long pauses and empty moments in that season finale. And there were just some times when I was looking for it to be maybe a little bit more kinetic and really a great culmination of everything. And I think that the finale is also maybe a little bit more sentimental. I'll talk about this one a little bit later on as we get deeper into it. But I think it was maybe a little bit overly sentimental in the way that it approached its character development. So I think that there are some problems in terms of the execution. And this kind of fit with a little bit, you know, when I did sort of read reviews of it, and many of the reviews were based on the early episodes, not the full series. But looking through them, it did seem like a lot of the reviews were saying, you know, it's good, you know, it's fine, it's not remarkable or extraordinary. It's a good, competent way to while away 45 minutes with your kid. And I would go with that. I was not totally displeased with it. I thought it was fine. I would have loved something more than fine, I guess. But, you know, it's not bad television. It's not, it wasn't terrible. And it has some really great individual moments. I don't know that it quite transcended the sum of its parts, though.
So one of the themes I want to get to, actually, you know, the content of the book and the series itself. So one of the themes in the book and the TV series revolves around human interaction with technology and media. And so how does the TV series address the role of technology, and, you know, particularly screen technology, is of interest to parents in the arc of the show, and especially because a lot of parents might be watching this or thinking about watching this series with their kids who've read the book.
Yeah, and I would say that, honestly, I feel like this is actually probably, this was one of the greatest fears I had for it when I was thinking about it as an adaptation, and actually turned out to be one of its best strengths through much of the first season. So, like I said, in one sense, the book and the show are kind of at a remove from contemporary society, right? Because they're not showing the influence of internet technology. But I think that's implied, you know, even though we have this kind of retro feel to it, and people are watching things on television and radio and newspaper and whatnot, it is still media consumption. It is still especially screen-oriented consumption. When the kids get to their dorm rooms in this new school that they're going to, the older students who have already been there for a while, who have risen through the ranks and whatnot, the kids find out that they have television screens in their rooms, and they're told, well, you should really just keep them on all the time, you know. And they're like, do we have to? And they're like, well, why wouldn't you want to? And so you can see that in Stewart's book, it's a key theme. And that gets really carried on very strongly throughout much of the early parts of the first season of the show, where the main characters are somewhat, if not immune to, at least very skeptical of the roles in which this information or disinformation or false messages, subliminal messages, are like being bombarded at them. And so with all of this stuff coming at them, the children, the one of the things that makes the children able to succeed in their quest is that they are not quite so susceptible as those around them. And I really appreciated that. And it manifests itself in another very interesting way, actually in a departure from the book. So the villain in the books, Mr. Curtin, is the twin brother of Nicholas Benedict, as I mentioned before. In the books, he's just kind of this misanthropic, growling, snarling individual. He's in this kind of like high-powered wheelchair. He wears these dark glasses, and he goes around kind of almost terrorizing people. He hates kids. Like, he just can't stand them, and which is ironic for somebody who's the head of a school. And he really is kind of almost a maniacal mad scientist kind of guy. The version of him in the series is really nothing like that. He really seems like somebody who could come right out of like a TED talk or an IT seminar. He's like this like maniacally twisted Steve Jobs kind of character. He talks in this very Silicon Valley kind of language. So he sounds very sort of like he's saying the right things about how he values people and how innovation is going to be good for society and for people. And he makes it appear as though he cares and is interested in others. But it's really ultimately about him controlling everything. So he's using his technology as a way to control other people who don't fit in with the way that he wants them to be. And so even though that is a big departure, and so part of me is like, oh, why can't you just make Mr. Kirk in the way that he was in the books? I did appreciate that this departure was one that I think actually, you know, went further in force, in step with the themes of the original book. Now, I will say by the end of the season, when he kind of moves forward in his technology, the screen-based component to it becomes less of a significant feature. And so and again, that does fit somewhat with the book, but at the same time, it also felt like it was kind of maybe losing a little bit of the bite to the critique that we saw in the early episodes. But overall, that was because it was itself a screen-based series. It was something which was showing on a streaming platform from Disney Plus, no less. I was a little bit nervous that that would get sacrificed. And overall, I didn't think that it was. I thought they did a decent job.
I do want to talk to you in a moment a little bit more about Mr. Curtin, because I didn't read the books, although my kids have. And I kind of felt like in this day and age, it came off a little on the creepy side. But first, I want to talk to you about Mr. Benedict, because obviously that's the title of these books, The Mysterious Benedict Society. And so how is he different in the show than the novels? It's kind of interesting, fascinating to me that the characters of Mr. Benedict and Mr. Curtin are just kind of like hero and villain, not in the same person, but in this set of twins. So that was kind of a very interesting device that the author did. But, you know, Mr. Benedict in the show, at least, comes across a little bit as this kind of genius, absent-minded professor. But at the same time, it seems a little bit at odds when they tell a little bit of his backstory in later episodes. And I have a question. Did you read the prequel novel about his story when he was a little kid, The Extraordinary Education of Nicholas Benedict? And did they take stuff from that and insert it when they're kind of telling his backstory about how he came to have this feud between he and his brother?
Yeah, this is a great question. I have not actually read the book myself, but I did consult with my kids beforehand to make sure that I was tracking with this, because I was trying to remember some stuff from the actual books that we did have to just confirm this. And so, yeah, they're very, very different. The whole prequel, The Extraordinary Education of Nicholas Benedict, Curtin never appears in it. He's not a character because they were separated at birth. So actually the book, The Mysterious Benedict Society, that's the first time that Nicholas Benedict learns he has a twin brother. He grew up in an orphanage, totally separated from him. And so this leads into, I think, one of what to me is, I think, I found a little bit of a problem with the depiction of Benedict in the series, is that he does not come across as somebody who is, maybe, quite frankly, he doesn't come across as somebody who, as much as he does in the book, as somebody worth trusting or worth putting yourself on the line for. So in the original depiction of Benedict, they do include something in the show that is similar, which is his narcolepsy, which is brought on by these sort of bouts of intense emotion. Now, that's a huge part of the books, because what it means is that in the books, Nicholas Benedict has to be a temperate individual. He has to be even keeled. If he's not, he's going to pass out. And over years, he's learned to kind of cope with this by basically, in general, trying to kind of not be super emotive, because he knows he could be endangering himself and his colleagues if too much of that happens. They mention it in the first episode of the show, and then like two or three episodes later, he's like going off into wildly emotive territory. Like at one point, he just like screams cathartically, and then he is experiencing all this guilt, because as you pointed out in the show, he has this whole backstory where he kind of basically abandoned his brother. Like, they were both at the same orphanage as kids. He gets adopted, his brother doesn't, and he never goes back to get his brother, and he feels great guilt for this. And so there's this endless hand-wringing by him on this, oh, I feel so guilty, oh, it's terrible, maybe I shouldn't have put the kids in this situation. And I mean, and I think that there's some value in being able to question our decisions and being able to sort of allow other people to speak truth to us to a certain extent. But honestly, he's just kind of wishy-washy and overly emotional in the show. And so, yeah, I think that's part of, I mentioned earlier, I think part of a general tendency in the show to really overplay the emotional level. And I don't want to underplay the emotional level. I think Stewart gets a good balance in the books. I think that he recognizes people have feelings, including kids. They have feelings. They need to be respected. But there are also times when we have to kind of do the right thing, even when it's the hard thing to do, even when we don't feel like doing it. And that's a great lesson that you can see in a lot of great children's stories. I don't know if you've ever read, it's a little bit darker, but like Neil Gaiman's book Coraline is a great one, where the kind of the whole message of that one is that being brave is being afraid, but doing the right thing anyway, doing what you need to do.
I saw the movie, but I didn't read the book, but I did read his book for young adults about the graveyard.
Okay, the graveyard book.
Which was very creepy.
Yeah, it is very creepy, right? But that idea that, like, yes, it is appropriate to recognize that we have feelings. That's a part of being human, and it's certainly a part of being a kid. And you don't want to just tamp them down totally. But that there are also times when you just have to kind of like do something. You'd have to kind of get beyond them. You have to harness them. And you also have to like train your feelings to be feeling the right thing to the right responses of things. And I feel like that is a key component of what makes the book distinctive. And I feel like that was kind of lost, especially in the character of Benedict. I did not feel like Tony Hale's portrayal, and I don't know if this is his issue or an issue with the writing or some combination of them. I think there's a lot of closing the gap between the virtues of Mr. Benedict and then the vices of Mr. Curtin. Again, trying to put all these shades of gray in them. And I understand that you want to show complex characters, but at the end of the day, it just made it a little bit less plausible that the kids would really be putting themselves on the line for Mr. Benedict or trusting him, given the way that he was portrayed in this. So I would honestly find that to be kind of like one of the weaker facets. I mean, he's constantly on these emotional highs where he has to be talked down by his other adult assistants, Rhonda Kazembe, number two, Milligan, and Rainey's kind of adoptive mother, Miss Paramel. Like, at various times, each of them has to like counsel him and bring him to more stability. And he just does not seem fully stable in the show. And I think that has ripple effects for how well we can really root for or follow along with the action of the show for the rest of the time.
So what about the other characters? I do want to talk to you a little bit about the villain, Mr. Curtin, his evil twin. And, you know, of course, the children, the setup, not necessarily the plot, reminded me of a series of unfortunate events, which I do not recommend. Mainly, I just felt like that worldview, and we're not going to get into a different children's series, is written by such an anti-Christian person. It definitely comes through. But there's a character in there called Count Olaf, and he's chasing after these children. And it reminded me of that in this. You know, here's this bad villain, Mr. Curtin, who's trying to, at least in the TV series, find out who's trying to sabotage him, and he suspects it's these certain children. And so he tries all these nefarious means to get to them. Is that true in the book side of things? And how are the other adult characters in the book portrayed? Because it had some of that, again, series of unfortunate events where the adults are clueless, they're a little bit doofuses, and they just seem like not knowing what really bad things are happening that they're just oblivious to.
Yeah. And again, I think that is first of all, that's a big difference, I think, between the book and the show in terms of the role that the adults play. As far as the influence of the actual series of unfortunate events, I think you brought out some really good points with a comparison there. I do not know of any direct comparison. I think it is interesting that the first Mysterious Benedict Society book comes out the year after A Series of Unfortunate Events concluded its run as a book series. And so, again, they have some similar aesthetic qualities to them in terms of kind of like the feel of the places where people live, and also some very big differences, most of all being, again, I think that you know, whereas A Series of Unfortunate Events seems to have this very kind of nihilistic picture of things, certainly a very
Oh, yes, it
dark
does.
worldview. And that is definitely not what one comes away with in the Mysterious Benedict Society. Again, I do not know enough about Stewart. Like, I cannot pinpoint any specifically like religious component to him. He feels very Catholic to me, quite frankly. I mean, so you've got this character, Benedict, who takes these children, these sort of orphans or these people who are outcasts, and brings them into this little society. They're even tested in a place called the Monk Building. So it's almost like this kind of, you get this like little, almost like kids' spy monasticism going on there. And again, he's kind of like training them and preparing them in these virtues. So there is this, and I can't say again that that's a specific worldview that Stewart holds, because he kind of plays it close to the vest when talking about himself on his what interviews he does do. But it certainly is at least an overall ethos to them that is very, very distinct from that of Lemony Snicket's books. Now, as far as how this comes out with the villains, again, I would say the villain, Mr. Curtin, in the books, he's the villain through many of the books. He's much more of an obvious sort of villain. He's growly and snarly. He does not get along with kids. And that's actually kind of the fact, not only is the irony of him being a schoolmaster who doesn't get along with kids, not only is that a big deal with it, but it also is kind of an important plot point, because that is kind of what causes him not to suspect that the kids are double agents. He just has so low an opinion of children, he doesn't realize that there are these spies in his midst. The one in the show is a little bit cannier. He kind of has this sense almost right from the start that the kids might be playing him, or at least he gives that sense. He's menacing in a much more smarmy kind of way. And like you said, he is kind of an unsettling figure, but also he's got this kind of whole backstory that leads him to be that way, right? He wants to control things because he doesn't want people to see him for who he really is. He doesn't want to appear vulnerable, so he wants to have everything under control. And that is why he's given this whole backstory, you know. As a child who wants to be adopted in the orphanage, he spends all this time trying to manufacture his own adoption by trying to be this cute kid that people will want, and it backfires and leads to his brother being adopted, but not him. And so that just leads to him doubling down even further and wanting even more to control people, which is why he becomes this technologist who ends up developing this device that is designed to try to control people. And so in the book, his narcolepsy is the same as his brother's, basically just intense emotion, and he passes out. Whereas in the TV show, his narcolepsy comes directly from his vulnerability, right? So it's that he is this poor, hurt human being who, when people start to really empathize with him and care for him, then he just autonomically shuts himself down, so that can't happen. So there's definitely this much more intensive emotional component to it. But because of that, he keeps everybody at kind of a distance. And so he has this kind of this menace that is coupled with a sort a little bit of emotional intelligence as well. So it makes him a kind of a creepy villain, a decent one, but again, really, really different. And then the kids themselves, I think, in terms of them as characters, you know, I think that the show does a decent job with more or less preserving the four kids' characters. And so, you know, Rainey, I think, is really, really close. Sticky is pretty close too. Kate, they make a few changes. They add a little bit of tension between them occasionally, you know, because it's a TV show, so they want some dramatic tension. They give Constance a whole lot more to do in the show. Throughout the book, one of the largest things that they're constantly wrestling with is why Mr. Benedict sent her in the first place. And it only really comes out at that very end when she's like, when her stubbornness literally destroys Curtin's machine. And then there's a big twist in the book, which is not in the movie. And I'll spoiler alert, so mute this if you haven't read the books and don't want to find this out. But like the big twist that you realize in the book, she's always portrayed as this child who's like small for her age. You know, she looks like really small. She's precocious and she talks a lot and is really stubborn and annoying. What you find out at the end of the book is that she's the reason that she's so extraordinary, in part, is she's only 2 years old. She's like this 2-year-old who's talking with a vocabulary of like a 6 or a 7 or 8 year old. But that's why she's so irascible and so unpleasant, because she's acting like a typical 2 or 3 year old in her emotional state, but her mental abilities are just like way beyond that. And so they didn't even try for that in the book. Like I mean, the actress who plays her is like 12, and she's depicted as maybe like, I don't know, like 6 or 7 maybe, or something like that. And maybe 5, but definitely they were not pushing her as a 2-year-old in this one. And so that was a little bit of a discrepancy, but overall, I mean, I think that those characters came across pretty well.
So what about some of the other themes in this series? I mean, would it be, I know Christian parents are probably thinking, okay, so should I allow my kids to read this book or watch this series? Because that's also, it's really for middle graders, I would say. And around that age, a lot of times it's really difficult if you have a more advanced reader or a voracious reader to find things that are age appropriate, which is why I found this particular book for my now early 20s son at the time, because he was a voracious reader. And like, how do you find age appropriate books? But in the series, it seems to me that there are some themes of friendship and sticking with people, even you might not like them at first, or you might have conflict, but to resolve conflict with them and work as a team. I'm thinking about the main character kids as the story unfolds in the film or in the TV series. But what are those themes there similarly in the book, or are there some other themes that are explored in the book that don't make it into the series?
Yeah, I think those actually are kind of in both, and I think that they're done very well in both. You know, again, I would say, so whichever medium we're exposed to first is usually going to be the one that sticks most with us, right? If we have read the book first, or if we have watched the show first, that's probably going to be the one that's going to be our baseline. Occasionally that might change, you know, we might really prefer the second thing to the first, but usually that first impression is going to be big, which is why I would, if possible, I would certainly counsel a parent to do the books first before the show, because I do think that they have some added positive qualities to them that don't make it all the way through. And my concern would be that knowing, because they are close enough, the book and the show are close enough to each other in at least in their overall arc, my concern would be that a kid who had seen the show would then go back and might find the books a little bit more boring because they knew enough about it, and then therefore not really be able to engage with it as well as they might otherwise be able to. Whereas I think they would actually be rewarded very significantly for sticking with the book all the way through first. But the theme particularly, and I'm glad that you brought this up, the theme that you mentioned before about kind of like working through conflict situations with a team is a major point. Now, the TV show, interestingly enough, kind of doubles that up. It does it with the kids and then also in the scenes with the adults. The book doesn't really present us almost with anything that the adults are doing once the kids hit the island. It's almost, and really almost nothing except what happens to Rainy and occasionally Sticky. Like those are the characters who we see everything through. So we're never really sure until the very end what exactly is happening with Mr. Benedict. And so that gives you, you have to have this kid's eye view of everything. You're in the dark with what's going on through much of the time when you're reading the book. And that means that they have to learn to trust each other while feeling sort of not necessarily abandoned, but certainly feeling alone. And that's particularly true, like I said, with the character of Constance. So you get these three characters who just naturally gel with each other and who each has his or her own gift that fits so snugly together with Rainy and with Sticky and with Kate. And then you've got Constance, who just doesn't seem to play a role. And Mr. Benedict frequently is like before they leave, he's like, okay, trust me, she's going to play a part in this. And it's just not immediately evident. And she does in the end, but in the book, it takes a long time before her role is evident. And before her contribution becomes evident. Most of the time, she is just this really annoying, she's the fourth member, but she's kind of like the fifth wheel in the wagon. She's like the extra thing that doesn't really seem to contribute much except unpleasant feelings throughout much of it. And you do get some of that in the show, maybe not quite as much, and they add some tensions between the core three characters. But yes, I think that's a great point of view, that you do have all of these children who, again, they have to get past their differences and they have to do what's best for one another and for their group, and not just what they feel like doing in a moment, and create this team together, manage those conflicts. And that is a key part of both of them. What I think, again, is a little different in the show is that in the show, the adults are seen doing that as well. And you could say that that's a positive thing, that you get to see them kind of doing it too. But it does, like you were talking about with the Lemony Snicket books, it does end up having that sort of sense sometimes, at least in the show, I got this sense like that the adults were kind of clueless or were kind of not necessarily as together as they might be. Whereas the books don't really play up that as much. The grownups aren't perfect, but they're certainly not bumbling or confused or in the dark in the same sense.
So there's three more books. And do you think, I did look after I finished watching it to find out if there's season two, because it shows, you know, Curtin and Benedict making a getaway, kind of. They're together. So there's a second book called Mysterious Benedict Society and the Perilous Journey. And do you think that they'll make another sequel? And if they did, I mean, I don't know if we know, it just doesn't say online, but would it be worth watching?
Yeah, these are great questions. And I like you, was kind of curious. I'm looking it up as of August 27th, when I'm recording this. I could not find any information explicitly. The closest I found was an interview with one of the showrunners. I can't remember offhand which one it was, but they were asking him, would you do a season two? And he was like, yes. And they're like, what would it be about? And he just said book two. So like, at least one of the people involved in the show would be interested in having season two be based, if it existed, would be having it based on The Perilous Journey. I'd be excited about that in some senses. The Perilous Journey is, the books get increasingly exciting as they go along. There's still a lot of buildup. They're still kind of long, but there is a little bit more overt action going on. There's a series of henchmen that Mr. Curtin has called the Ten Men, who don't really appear significantly in the first book, but who are these menacing figures throughout the later books and who I'd be very interested to see portrayed. The Perilous Journey is also a lot more global. Like, there's a lot of, they pop around different countries. Mr. Benedict in the book is originally from, or at least has some origins in the Netherlands. And I believe they're in the Netherlands and other parts of Europe at various times. They're on a deserted island that's very, like, I think near Scotland, if I recall correctly, or at least very far from the United States. And so there's a lot more. It's not just in one place. It's much more of a globe-trotting type of text. And so those would be just a lot of, again, a lot of fun to see. I guess, again, my concern would be, like, are they going to just keep doubling down on these thematic alterations? Are we going to get a lot more of this kind of, not just, again, not just emotion, because I think emotion is good, but inability to kind of manage it productively or effectively? Will they continue sort of to change or alter the characters in these ways? I'm not sure, but I would certainly be willing and interested to see it as a possibility. And the kind of cliffhanger with Mr. Curtin at the end of the first season, you know, he's got this sort of scientist character. She kind of works with him. She's not even a character in the books that I can tell. And they added, I think, to give a face to his inventions. And so she is like handing something to him. She like gives him something that you don't really see what it is. But if it's like a map of the kind of thing that they're searching for in the second book, that could be where they're going. But, you know, who knows? It's on Disney Plus now, right? So they may have their own demands and they may want something completely different. So, but I would watch it. I'd give it a chance. I'd be interested in seeing what it's like. Like I said, the TV show, it is not a bad show. I enjoy it. I enjoyed it well enough. I think it could have been stronger, but there's a lot worse things. And again, to go back to the original point, if you were a Christian parent and you wanted to show your kids the show, like, I don't think it's terrible. You know, I don't think there's tons objectionable to it. And I think there are some very positive things to it. I don't think it is as good as the level set by its source material, but I think it's not bad. I think that there are a lot worse things out there that you could be exposing them to.
So for the Christian parent that does say, okay, I'll let my child read the book or watch the series, how can they engage in discussion about spiritual themes that the book can help their kids think through?
Oh, that's a great question. Interesting. I would, you know, so a couple of things that we could think through. I mean, part of it, of course, will depend on the relationship you have with your kids. You know, being an English teacher, I have a relationship with my kids where we are frequently talking about the kinds of things that we're reading. And, you know, so you can sort of, when you've got the kids interacting with each other and talking to each other, like kind of teasing out like, okay, is this the right response in this kind of situation? Did they make a good choice at this point or not? Or you can even ask, you know, about the more that the villain's situation becomes coming up, like you could be posing these questions, like, why do you think he wants to act that way? And like I said, because it has this kind of critique built into it of overuse of screen technology, you know, I know a lot of us, we have situations with our kids where they are frequently interacting with screens because of the world that we live in. And so I think it's very good early on as parents for us to just have our kids be aware of that, aware of their usage of devices, and not just take them as like, oh, this is just part of life, but think about like, what are the messages we're getting from these? What are the implications of the things that we're allowing to come through our eyes? So I think that, you know, having kids early on be thinking on these terms, I think could be very positive for them, like as they are watching something streaming or as they've got something on their device, like be talking to them about like what could be coming in, you know, should we be thinking about how we use these things and not just as a toy that we play with, but as something that actually is shaping us, shaping our love, shaping our affection, shaping our virtues or moving us away from virtues. And I think there's just a lot of ethical and moral situations and very interesting dilemmas or questions that at various individual points in the text that really can come up. You know, the kids are spies, so they have to be sometimes lying about what they're doing. Is that okay? Is it okay to do that? That's a great kind of conversation to have with your kids about how truth and honesty works. And Trenton Lee Stewart's books in general sort of invite those kinds of philosophical ones. In fact, the third book, The Mysterious Benedict Society and The Prisoner's Dilemma, it's based on a philosophical conundrum, The Prisoner's Dilemma. So you've got these young kids reading this, and it's giving you all these great opportunities to be able to think through, okay, what does our faith look like in these challenging situations that don't have very clear answers? How might we react? How would you react if you were a kid in these situations? So I think there's a lot of fruitful food for thought that parents could get from interacting with the text, but certainly even interacting with the TV show as well.
Well, finally, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Jeffrey, and these are done to help our listeners get to know our authors a little bit better on a personal level. So Jeffrey, what is your favorite meal?
Bacon cheeseburger.
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
I'm a night owl and an early bird, which means I don't get a lot of sleep. I want to be a night owl, but I have to be an early bird.
Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
Right in the middle.
And boy, you seem to be just 50-50 of everything. Are you highly organized and scheduled, or are you spontaneous and go with the flow?
Really, probably neither. I'm not terribly organized, but I'm very not spontaneous.
And we talked about novels today. So what's one of your favorite novels?
Oh, I could go on all day. But that first one is always going to be The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Melanie.
You've been listening to episode 253 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Jeffrey Ryder. He has written an online exclusive television series review for the journal. His article is called, Does the Mysterious Benedict Society Have the Right Stuff? And our subscribers can read his article for free at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.